where it came from, he says. She was adopted, but she'd already been named. The agency told my grandparents it would be best for her if they kept it. That's why she was always so anxious about health stuff, you know, because she doesn't have a family medical history or anything. I thought I'd told you that.
You didn't. The floor sways under me as questions start burbling up through my mind. You mentioned the health anxiety, but not the rest. He sits up straighter, his brows knitting.
Are you okay?
I don't know where that sentence was going. Am I okay? Am I seeing connections where there are none? Journalism will do that to you sometimes, make you view the world as a puzzle to be solved. His mother has the same name as an old hotel the Ives family owned. So what? The same name as the little sister Lawrence left home to save, and the name given to Ruth Nicolette Allen, a secret Ives baby. Slightly more coincidental, but ultimately meaningless. But then there's what Hayden told me, about how he's gotten here. He didn't track Margaret down. She tracked him down. I close my eyes to stop the room from spinning. What year was your mom born? I ask. His forehead wrinkles.
What?
Just when was she born? I say, flustered. He laughs uneasily.
1967. Now are you going to tell me what all this is about?
He starts to rise, alarm written across his face.
Alice, are you okay?
That reminded me of something, and I step back from him. My phone alarm goes off then, shrieking out its warning that I have to leave this second or risk being late to my last appointment with Margaret. I break out of the trance, though my mind is still reeling, my body alternating between flaming hot and ice cold. I'm running late, I stammer, hurrying for the door.
Alice?
He shouts after me. I'll call you when I'm done, I promise without looking back, my face on fire. I grab my bag by the door, realize I still have the mosaic in my hand, and stuff it in on top of my computer. And then I run. I sit in my car on Margaret's private street, sorting furiously through my notes. I'm no longer worried about being late. When she sends me a text reminding me that we agreed on 9 a.m. and it's now 9:07, I ignore it. She's lied to me enough. I'm not going inside until I'm ready, until I'm sure she can't lie anymore. I find my notes from the day I confronted her about the Nicolette's name, a name she'd intentionally tried to hide from me. She'd told me that the name was a reference to Lawrence's little sister, the reason he'd headed west, and the thing he'd given up, and she'd admitted Ruth was Gerald's biological daughter, and all of that had felt like such a grand reveal, a secret I'd unearthed. But what if that wasn't even the secret she was trying to hide? What if it was a distraction? I page through the transcript of our conversation, and there it is. Whatever you tell me, it doesn't have to go beyond this room, I told her. Even at the time, her response seemed strange. This includes the boy. I have two NDAs, so whatever I tell you, you can't take it to him. You understand that, don't you? Every time the non-disclosure agreement has come up, the person she's been most concerned about has been Hayden. Not me blabbing to People magazine for a price, but sharing bits of information with the other writer in the running. As if we've been getting different stories all along. Which leads me straight to Hayden's uncertainty about this job from the beginning, his suspicion that she was lying, with every word she said, keeping something from him. That she wanted to talk to him, but not about herself, about anything else, about him, like she wanted to know him. My mind is spinning. I can't tell if this is just some weird hangover mixed with years of constant coffee chugging, or if I've stumbled onto something. 1967. His mother is named Nicolette, and she was born in 1967, less than a year after Cosmo's death. 1967, when Margaret sent her mother back to Los Angeles, let all of her staff go, and shut herself away in her and Cosmo's Nashville home. For 2 years, seeing no one except Cecil Willoughby, their trusted family doctor. Something else pings in the back of my brain, and I'm paging furiously through my notes again, back to Nina Gill's secret pregnancy. 9 months would have been too suspicious. They had to drag it out and publicize it when they were able. Nina had spent 2 years in the Alps. A part of me still won't believe it. I thrust the papers into the passenger seat and pull out the mosaic next. Nicolette, the person you'd do anything for, the only one who could make you give it all up. 5x5, with tiny pieces of warm-toned glass, translucent reds and ambers, golds, fitted into a tight spiral like a miniature galaxy. The longer I stare at it, the more the feeling grows in me. The truth. I feel it there, bursting to escape its cage. I stuff the mosaic into my bag and get out of the car. I enter Margaret's house without knocking. "Finally!" I hear her call from deep within the house. I don't reply, don't take my shoes off, just let my feet carry me to the living room as if I'm on a track. Like maybe I don't have free will. Maybe I was always going to end up here from the moment I was born and there was never any stopping it. She stands from her rattan chair when she sees me storm in, her brows shifting toward her hairline.
"Alice, are you all right? You don't look well. If you're sick..."
I thrust the mosaic at her. Her eyes waver toward it. Her lips press tight, her face otherwise impassive, but I can see the wheels turning behind her eyes, calculating what I might know, all the reasons I might hold this out to her like an accusation. There's really only one. Her eyes finally lift to mine.
"What is this?"
she breathes.
"You tell me,"
I say. She stares back at me, her face stony, and for the first time, I see it. The resemblance. The whole world rocks.
"Is Hayden your grandson?"
I ask. Another beat of perfect silence.
"Who else have you talked to about this?" she says. "Because I'll remind you..."
"I have a non-disclosure." I cut her off. "I'm aware." Her lips press closed. She doesn't say anything else. She doesn't deny it either.
"You have a daughter," I say.
"No," she says quietly, and then, in a low murmur,
"I had one for 9 months while I carried her, and I knew there was no way she could live. Not as herself, not the way we wanted her to."
Her voice shakes.
"Our daughter was born, and I held her in my arms for 5 minutes. 5 minutes, and that was all it took for me to be sure that I couldn't keep her, that I loved her too much. So I watched her be carried out of the room, and Nicolette Ives stopped existing."
"Cecil helped you?"
I force the words past the knot in my throat.
"He helped you hide your pregnancy after the accident, delivered her, orchestrated the adoption."
"He was the only other person who knew," she says weakly. "The one who tested me. We'd only found out a week earlier and..."
Her throat bobs.
"Cosmo was an anxious wreck. I'd started spotting. I knew it probably wasn't anything, but he wanted to be sure."
"There was no appendicitis?" I ask.
She shakes her head, eyes welling.
"I should have made him listen. But he was in such a panic. And then, on the road, the paparazzi. He was so angry and scared. What were we thinking? That's what he kept saying. We both understood right then what it would be like for her. She'd never belong to herself, never. And then..."
She chokes over a sob.
"Then he was gone. And I knew I had to save her, like I couldn't save him. That's what we did, Cecil and I. We saved her."
My mind swirls, a drunken carousel of hurt, sorrow, confusion. And in the middle of it all, a tall, still figure.
"Does he know?" I rasp. "Have you told Hayden why he's really here?"
A new thought crashes into my mind, knocking everything even further off balance.
"If the job was always his, why even bring me here?"
"He doesn't know," she croaks. "And it wasn't his. The job, it didn't exist."
I pinch the bridge of my nose.
"The book..."
"There wasn't going to be a book."
Her jaw muscles leap, an expression that's so Hayden it makes my chest feel like there's a crack spreading down it.
"I just needed time."
"Time?" I demand feebly.
"To get to know him," she says. "To see if she was happy, if there was a chance I might... that she might forgive me someday."
"You were messing with me."
It feels like my lungs are folding in half, my heart crushed between them. She stares at me, saying nothing.
Why? My voice rattles as it gains volume. Why bring me here? Why do all of this?
Because he wouldn't come otherwise, she cries. I tried to entice him to the island before, and he didn't reply, so I gave up. I was okay with it, but Jody wouldn't let it go. She sent you that damn email.
Jody, I say. Why?
Because she's a meddler, she says. Because she thinks she's doing her mother's bidding. She figured with another writer in the mix, she could make Hayden see this as legitimate, as a story worth fighting for.
I try to hold back the angry tears rising along my lashes. You were using me.
At first, she replies. But this whole thing, Alice, you changed my mind. You made me feel like maybe I could share my story. I thought if I told Hayden the truth, if he accepted it, then maybe we could write the book after all. Nothing about him or his mother, of course. We'd protect their privacy, but the rest, everything that happened to Laura, everything I wish the world knew about my parents, my husband.
She shakes her head, eyes tight.
And then he came here yesterday and told me he didn't want the job.
My heart trips over a beat. What? Her eyes open. She looks as distraught as I've ever seen her, like somehow this, out of everything she's been through, was the blow she couldn't take. I sway on the spot, lean against the nearest wall. He already turned it down?
I wouldn't tell him about Cecil, she says. And then he said it didn't matter because he'd already decided he wasn't the right person for the job. But the truth is, he disliked me. From the beginning, I could tell. Jody doesn't want to hear it, keeps storming out every time I cancel one of these little chats, but it's been clear from the start. That boy wants nothing to do with me, even as a subject, even as a paycheck.
He doesn't know you, I half shout. How could he? You've lied to him every single day for a month.
I never lied to him, she counters. I only avoided certain things.
You have to tell him the truth. My chest throbs from the betrayal, from the unfairness. You can't keep this from him. She shakes her head.
He doesn't want the truth from me. He doesn't want anything from me. And neither does his mother.
You don't know that, I fire back.
I do,
she says.
How? Because I saw her,
she all but screams back. For a second, the house falls eerily quiet. Then she takes a step toward me, her voice shrinking to a plea.
I waited until she was 18, and then I found her, through an investigator. She was living in Indiana with this beautiful family, and I thought, I don't know what I thought. I tried to let it be enough that she was alive, that she seemed happy, but I couldn't stop thinking about her. I needed proof.
Proof of what? I demand.
That I'd done the right thing, she says. That when I gave her up, there really wasn't another option. That's why I started trying to disappear, to see if I could do it. If maybe I didn't have to.
Her voice becomes garbled as emotion sticks in her throat.
If maybe I didn't need to let her go. And every time the paparazzi caught me, I found just a tiny fucking kernel of comfort. Because it meant I did the right thing. And every year when her birthday passed and they still hadn't found out about her, it made it all worth it. It was the only reason I could sleep at night. The only thing keeping me going. I was okay, finally, being alone. Until Jody showed up.
Her jaw muscles twitch.
But after I sent Jody off, the thought of my sister never let me go again. I'd been a shut-in for years at that point, but suddenly I couldn't take it anymore. Being in that house filled with ghosts, everyone I'd lost, everyone my family had ever hurt. I sold off Ives Media and got rid of the money, donated nearly all of it, and still I felt like that house, all that history was suffocating me. So one day I just went out, and I wandered around town for hours, and no one spoke to me. No one even looked at me. Not a soul. I went to the beach, and the same thing happened. I kept waiting for someone to recognize me, but I'd stopped dyeing my hair or wearing makeup, and more importantly, I was 67 years old. At some point, while I'd been hiding, I'd crossed that age where women turn invisible. From ingenue to femme fatale to old crone.
She gives a shred of smile, but I don't return it. My emotions are all over the place. Anger, disappointment, hurt, sadness, and the last month's worth of conversations are a swirling, chaotic mess. Everything Hayden's told me about his mother, about her depression and the anxieties and hurts she passed on to him, is colliding with Margaret's story, and I just need a minute to breathe, to make sense of it all, and figure out what to do next. But she's on a roll now, her story pouring out of her. At the end of that day, I got back in my car to drive home, and I just couldn't do it. Not again. I headed east instead, drove as far as I could, then stopped at a motel, paid in cash so I wouldn't have to use my name. In the morning, I kept driving, and eventually I made it to the address on that little card Jody left behind on a small island in Georgia. Her voice cracks. We had 6 months together, my sister and I. We were both such different people since the last time we saw each other, and somehow still it was like no time had passed at all. We still belonged to each other, belonged with each other. 6 beautiful, terrible months, and then she was gone. But not until she'd made me promise to tell Nicolette the truth. I would have agreed to anything Laura asked at that point, she says roughly. But I knew she was wrong about it. The best thing for Nicolette now is the same as back then. I put it off as long as I could, but Jody never let me forget. Finally, she hired a detective, and it turned out she needn't have bothered. She shakes her head on a laugh as tough and coarse as sandpaper. Could have found Nicolette with one little Google search. She'd married a small-town politician and found her way back under the microscope. A smaller microscope, sure, but just as cruel as any. How's that for an Ives curse? I gave up an entire lifetime with her, and it wasn't enough to keep her safe.
It's not too late, I say, vehement. The only thing keeping you from her now is you. You have to tell Hayden. He deserves to know the truth. So does his mother and his brother.
The truth. She scoffs. Haven't you been listening these past 4 weeks? The truth hasn't been the story that shapes the world for a long time. I'm no one to him and his family, and that's for the best. So no, I'm not going to tell him. And you're not either.
The last sentence slices through me. The implication. The threat. The millions of dollars I'd owe this woman if I broke our agreement. There's a desperate, almost ruthless gleam in her eyes. Suddenly, my whole body is sweating, and my heart jabs at my chest like a woodpecker's beak, clumsy and forceful. Margaret takes a half step toward me.
Hayden doesn't want to do this book, she says. But we still can, Alice. I'm sorry for dragging you down here under false pretenses. I'm sorry I wasn't the woman you thought I was, and that this didn't play out how you'd hoped. But I'll do what I can to help you now, how you helped me. We might not be able to tell the whole truth, but we can add to the story, right some of the wrongs of the past. That's what you were after, isn't it? Finally telling that story your dad always wanted to know?
White hot pain lances through me. I'm not doing that. Her right brow hooks upward.
What? You think all those celebrity memoirs tell the whole truth? Everyone's got secrets, Alice.
It's not about that. I step back from her. This is about your life, Nicolette's life. I swallow a thorny knot. Hayden's life. He deserves a choice in all of this.
He had one,
she says, her voice pitching upward, like she's begging me to understand.
He met me. He doesn't like me. I can't change who I am, and I'm not going to change him either. So what good does it do to bust open his whole life? What good does it do anyone?
It's so eerily similar to what I said to Hayden when he pressed me about talking to my mom, and now, from the outside, I hear how hollow it rings. Because I also see how bright and damp her eyes are. See the tension in her shoulders and the way her hands fist at her sides, her knuckles white. And after years of knowing her as sunny smiles and bright clothes and open-mouthed laughs, I finally see the truth of her, everything that she's inherited. Lawrence's guilt over failing the people he loved, and Gerald's anger over the love that always remained out of his reach, and Freddie's fear of not being enough for the ones who mattered most. The terror of what happens if you ask for something someone's not able to give you. And it seems so asinine, because she doesn't have the love she longs for now anyway. She's lonely. This house is bursting with loneliness, and she's so used to hiding away in it that she won't even let herself imagine things being different.
Telling him would only make things worse, she whimpers. Jody's already furious with me, but I thought at least you would understand.
I understand the story you're telling, I choke out, the fire dying down inside me. But the truth is, you're just scared. I turn to go.
Alice, Margaret says, if you leave now, there's no going back, so think about this.
I pause for just a second at the mouth of the hallway. She looks so small and frail, it breaks my heart. See, I tell her, our choices do matter. And then I leave. 34. The whole drive back to the bungalow, I'm fighting tears, trying to make some kind of plan, and coming up against all the same walls every time. I can't tell Hayden the truth. I can't lie to him. My phone is full of messages from my friends, checking how the pitch went, asking for updates. I silence it and drive to the beach. Don't even get out of my car, just sit there with the front bumper pressed up against a dune, sobbing. I'm not even totally sure why I'm so emotional. I'm sad about losing the job, sure. I'm heartbroken for Margaret, for the decision she made, and the love behind it, and how all that love congealed into a hard shell around her, keeping everyone out. And I'm devastated for Hayden, for me. When I'm all cried out, I drive home. I leave my laptop bag in the car and go inside, immediately start packing my stuff, ignoring the crying Jags that start and stop at random. I can figure out flights later. I just know I'm not staying here. Around 2 o'clock, there's a knock on the door. I go to open it, and the pain I feel at finding Hayden on my doorstep, another bottle of champagne in hand, is physical, a perforated edge down the middle of my heart.
I know we said you'd buy the champagne tonight,
he begins. I'm not taking the job. I choke out before he can go any further. His mouth drops open.
What?
I swallow the jagged tangle in my throat. I'm not taking it.
I don't understand,
he says. You should, I say. You passed on it too. Slowly, his face slackens.
Wait, are you mad about that?
You're the one who wanted me to know I earned it, I say, paraphrasing him, like it matters at all, like any of this matters. I'm not angry with him, but I'm angry, and it's seeping into everything else, poisoning it. And then you just withdraw yourself at the last minute. So which is it? Do I deserve it, or did you think I didn't have a chance? He gapes at me.
Fuck, Alice. Of course I thought you had a chance. I also thought you'd do a better job than I would, and I didn't want this dumb shit to come between us.
You didn't trust me not to resent you, I clarify. His mouth jams shut.
I didn't want to put you in the position where you had to even consider it, and I didn't want the job that badly.
And now I don't want it either, I say, tears burning in the back of my nose. Not now, not at the cost of the truth, not at the cost of him. Is that so hard to understand?
Yes,
he says, vehement.
This is your dream job.
Exactly. It was just a dream, I force out. The reality isn't what I thought.
You're lying to me, Alice.
His voice strains with hurt.
What's going on?
I shake my head, backing away from him as he moves closer, guarding that distance between us like it can do anything to protect my breaking heart. I can't, I grind out.
Alice, what is this? He pleads. Tell me. Tell me what's going on. If I did something to hurt you, then tell me how to fix it and I'll do it, okay? Anything.
I jerk back from him as he reaches for me, trembling from the effort of not breaking into sobs. I can't, I say more harshly. Ask Margaret.
I don't want to ask Margaret,
he fires back.
Margaret's not important. You are.
I'm sorry, I say. And then again, like I'm a skipping record, I'm sorry. I can't give you any more than that. I can't make this make sense for you.
Not just because of the NDA, but because of Margaret. Because no matter how furious I am with her, this is her story to tell. That's what I promised her before I knew the truth, and it's still what I believe.
All you have to do is be honest,
he says helplessly.
Just talk to me.
Please don't ask me again, I whimper. I don't have anything to say.
He stares at me, his disbelief curdling into a frustrated resignation.
So that's it?
I want to tell him to stay, to beg him to. But I already know it won't work, that he won't be able to let this go, that even if he could, for a night or two, this secret would eat away at this thing between us. Margaret will go back into hiding, and then someday she'll be gone. And if I did finally tell him myself then, how could he forgive me for lying to him for so long? Please go, I whisper. He stares at me for a long beat, his dark eyes glazing with tears.
Goodbye, Alice,
he finally chokes out, then turns and walks back down the path, away from me, while I try not to break, try not to call after him, try not to tell him now, in the worst possible moment, when all I can do is wound, that I love him like I've never loved anyone. When he's gone, I shut the door and slump onto the floor, letting a fresh torrent of tears overtake me. I'm not sure how long it goes on, minutes or hours, but when I catch my breath and my hiccups settle, I pull my phone out and text my mom. Would it be okay if I came home for a while? I'm not doing well right now. The dots appear to indicate she's typing back. She says what she always says. Sure. Under the hideous neon green quilt in my childhood bedroom, I half-heartedly search for other jobs. Aging celebrities who might want to tell their stories, dating trends that could become articles for The Scratch, and restaurants back in Los Angeles that might need servers. Because if I'm being honest, right now, the last thing I want to do is my current job. I told my friends the bare-bones details, that I'm not moving forward with Margaret, that I'm spending a few days with my mom. But since then, I've been more or less ignoring their texts. I think about calling Hayden, but what else can I say? I could assure him that I want to be with him, beg him to let this one secret sit. But if he ever found out, could he forgive me for knowing something this huge and keeping it from him? Could he even take being in a relationship with someone he knows, in essence, is lying to him every single day, the same way that Margaret was? I play mental games with myself. If he calls me right now, I'll tell him everything. I debate whether Margaret would ever forgive me, like it's a game of he loves me not, and if I just happen to pluck a flower petal at the right moment, all my problems could go away. After 3 days of moping, Mom walks into my room, flips on the lights, and grunts, "If you're going to be here, you might as well work." I don't have a good argument for that. I get dressed and meet her in the garden. I kneel beside her in the dirt, and without looking at me, she takes Dad's hat off her head and holds it out to me, one hand still digging with a spade. My heart pings at the gesture, at the familiarity of it, the quiet care. I put it on and get to work. For the next 2 days, we plant. Irish potatoes and squash, more cucumbers and snap beans. We prepare the soil for the upcoming cool season planting, clearing out the empty beds, turning the dirt with fertilizer. We take the broccoli seeds she started inside last month and plant them, along with collards and onions. I feed the chickens, and I collect their eggs. I pick the ripe fruit from the stand of trees, and I manage the compost toilet. I take short, scalding hot showers, and I help cook every meal. My limbs ache, but my mind, finally, goes quiet. On my fifth night there, we sit down to eat in near silence, the same way we've eaten every meal since I got here. Across from me, at the far end of the old wooden table, Mom picks up her fork, then sets it down again. "Are you going to tell me what's going on, kid?" Do you want me to? I ask, surprised. She sits back in her chair, mismatched from mine, all of them found in trash heaps on curbs or at thrift stores and lovingly restored by her and Dad. What the hell kind of a question is that? She demands. Sorry, I say quickly, searching for a way to backtrack. Dear God, Alice, she says. I know I'm not winning Mother of the Year anytime soon, but do you really think I'm that awful? That I'd see my kid in pain and not care? That's not it at all, I say. If something happened, she replies, you can tell me. If you lost your job, just say it. Sorry to disappoint you, I murmur, looking down at my full plate. But no, I didn't lose my job. Sorry to disappoint me? She says, aghast. You think I want you to get fired? This just keeps getting worse and worse. I want to rush to smack a band-aid on it, to take back or explain away that little comment. But the truth is, now that my mind is clear enough to think, the memory of what Margaret said keeps surfacing. What good does it do anyone? He doesn't like me. I can't change who I am, and I'm not going to change him either. I push back from my plate, and with a shuddering breath, force the words past the thickness in my throat. You've never respected my job. You don't respect me for doing it. You think it's stupid and shallow and a waste of time, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry I'm not like Audrey. I'm sorry I'm not saving the world, and I'm not living a perfectly carbon-neutral life, and I spend money on unnecessary things like manicures and candles and romance novels, but this is who I am, and even if you don't understand it, couldn't you just pretend for a few days a year that you respect me, that you like me? Because I can't figure out how to be anyone else, and it's lonely. It's so fucking lonely being the person who doesn't belong in this family. She stares at me, agog, blank-faced. My chest heaves as I try to even out my breathing. My eyes, I realize, are glossed with tears, and I'm gripping my fork like a lifeline. 1 second ticks by. Another. I wonder if she'll just pick up her fork and go back to eating, pretend this never happened. I wonder if she'll scream, if she'll let me have it the way I just did to her. Finally, she cracks. Oh, honey. Her chair scrapes back from the table, and she comes around toward me, crouching to wrap me in her arms. The simple contact, the tight hug with no casual backslapping, no rush to pull away, makes me start to cry in earnest. You belong, she murmurs, kissing the top of my head. Never doubt that. I don't, I argue, my voice wrenching upward. My mom grips my shoulders in her hands, kneeling beside me. Alice, she says calmly. I respect you. I love you. I like you. But I don't understand you. I blink away the tears, and her elfin features come back into focus. Your dad. She shakes her head and tries again. When you were a tiny little girl, you were always glued to my side, all day, every day. Audrey was more independent, but you were my shadow. I sniff, wipe my eyes. I was? She nods. And as you grew up, grew into yourself. I don't know how to explain this in a way that won't make me seem like an asshole, so I'll just say it. The first few years as a mom, I felt like you and your sister were pieces of my heart walking around outside my body. You were your own people, but you were also mine. It feels like a miracle, because it is. You had your father's DNA, and you had mine, and somehow that made a whole new person who was both of us and neither. And then you started growing up, and you found new things to like. Things I'd never even really considered. Pieces of yourself that were all you, and you didn't need me anymore. It was amazing. It's what's supposed to happen. But it was terrifying, too, to let you grow past me. Suddenly, there were all these locked doors that used to be wide open hallways. Mom, I didn't need you because I didn't let myself. Because Audrey was sick, and I thought that's what everyone wanted from me, for me to just be okay, happy. And I was. I figured it out. I know, she says.
And that breaks my heart, because I wish I could have been there more. Not just when Audrey was sick, but since then, too.
Your dad would have.
She chokes up again, but she forces herself onward.
Your dad understood you.
Her voice squeaks, and her shoulders lift in a slight shrug.
He understood the things you love. He understood your sense of humor. He had access to pieces of you I couldn't get to, and I was okay with that, mostly. But when he died, God, Alice, I haven't been able to figure out how to be what you need. He always knew the right thing to say to you. He always knew how to cheer you up or how to talk you down. And I want to be a good parent to you, but I can't be him.
I don't need you to be him, I promise tearily.
You deserve to have him, she says. You don't know how many times I've wished it had been me instead.
Mom. My heart cracks, shatters. I wrap my arms around her again. Don't say that. Her voice shivers out of her, wispy and ragged.
I miss him so much.
I shut my eyes, the tears still managing to pour through my lashes.
Me too, I squeak. I should have asked him more. I should have written it all down. I should have recorded every stupid joke and every piece of advice. I should have taken videos of him singing in the kitchen while you cooked. I should have tried to know all of him while I had the time, before it was too late.
My mom's embrace loosens, and she sits back on her heels, swiping her own tears away.
Baby girl, she says, it's not too late. What do you want to know?
We prop my phone up on the table with a stack of old books set to video. I place my recorder next to it, both angled toward where Mom sits with a stack of old photo albums. I hit record on each, then go join her at the table.
Where should we start? She asks me.
The beginning, I say. She opens album after album until she finds the book she's looking for.
Our commune days, she says, smiling affectionately at the first Polaroid of them, out in the sun, each in overalls, both skinnier and younger.
He has his arm slung around her. He's wearing a different, though not dissimilar, wide-brimmed hat.
You said he was ridiculous? I ask her, and her smile widens. The most ridiculous, she says.
Tell me everything, I say.
Only if you'll do the same, she says.
I hold out my hand. We shake on it. Then we take turns, sharing our stories. The next morning, I sit down at the desk in Audrey's room and start to write a letter. After speaking with Mom, I know what I need to say. I can't control how it will be received, but I have to try. I've just finished when I hear the pounding at the front door, followed by Mom's footsteps, and then a few overlapping voices. The back of my neck tingles as I stand and make my way through the small house toward the laughter and conversation. In the entryway, I stop short at the sight of them, kicking off their shoes.
Alice!
Priya squeals and bounds toward me, wrapping me in a hug. What are you doing here? I say, flabbergasted, as Priya releases me.
Your mom invited us,
Killian says, hugging me next. I look over his shoulder toward my mom.
Did you go through my phone?
I say, more confused than upset.
Of course not,
Mom replies, seemingly a bit offended by the accusation. We exchanged numbers last time I was here, Bianca says, sidling up to hug me next.
I hold on for a long moment, so grateful for these people who show up for me even when I don't ask them to.
I'm glad you're here, I get out.
Really? Priya says. Then why, pray tell, haven't you been texting us back?
It's a long story, I say. Would anyone like some tea or coffee? Mom asks.
I, for one, would love some, Angie, Killian says, following my mom down the hallway,
gawking at everything he passes and quickly throwing a look over his shoulder at me as he says,
It's so nice to finally be invited here.
He's never going to let it go that he was the last one to visit here, is he? I say. If you die first,
Bianca says, threading an arm through mine and turning me to follow him. He'll mention it in his eulogy. 35. I can't tell them everything, but I tell them enough. That the job with Margaret imploded, that it took Hayden's and my budding relationship with it, that it made me doubt myself and the work. We can lighten your load at the scratch for a while, Bianca promises, while you figure things out. I don't want to put anyone in a bad spot, I say.
Alice, you're in a bad spot, Killian says.
It's fine, I say. This really isn't that big of a deal, all things considered.
Well, then stop considering all things for a minute, Priya says.
This doesn't have to be the greatest tragedy to ever befall anyone. It doesn't even have to be the worst thing that's ever happened to you.
Exactly, Bianca agrees.
You're hurting right now. That's what matters.
I'm so glad you're all here, I say again. And when Killian opens his mouth, surely to say something snarky, I add, especially you, Killian.
And we all dissolve into laughter. I show them around the property, let them take pictures with Marietta, the friendliest of our chickens. Mom puts us to work for an hour in the afternoon, and afterward we take turns using our house's one shower. Killian is craving pizza, so for the first time I can remember, ever, my mom agrees to order some. As we're waiting for the delivery, she and I make a peach crumble and set it out to cool while we eat dinner. After Mom goes to bed, we play three quarters of a game of Monopoly, then agree that we hate Monopoly too much to play for another second.
We should have a sleepover, Priya says.
That's literally what this is, Pri, Bianca says.
No, I mean we should all sleep in the living room together, Priya says.
I'm too old to sleep on the floor, Killian says through a yawn.
But I hate sleeping alone, Priya says.
I'll sleep with you,
Killian offers, waggling his eyebrows.
Never again, Priya says, because that actually is how their friendship began.
I meant platonically, Killian insists.
It's either that, or one of you takes Audrey's room and the other takes the couch, I say. Priya pouts.
Why can't I sleep with you?
Because I already called it within 10 minutes of getting here, Bianca says.
Fine, Priya says. Killian, you're back in.
Well, now I'm not sure I'm up for it, Killian says,
and they squabble for a minute while we're all standing up and saying our goodnights. In the end, he and Priya take Audrey's room, and Bianca and I tuck ourselves into my bed. You seem better, she murmurs sleepily as we settle in. You guys lifted my spirits, I say. She shakes her head.
No, I mean, you seem somehow happier than you did before you left. More at peace or something.
It's strange, but she's right. I feel at once utterly heartbroken, and also like a weight has been lifted off my shoulders. I miss Hayden. I love him. But after sending that letter, I've done what I can. I've done what I need to do to live a life without any more regrets.
I'm thinking about writing a memoir, I whisper up to the dark ceiling.
Bianca turns over to face me.
Really?
I nod.
About my parents. About everything they've taught me.
That's a beautiful idea, Bianca says. It's not a Margaret Ives biography, I say. There's no guarantee anyone will want it.
You can't think about that yet, Bianca says.
Right now, you just have to think about what you want to write about. I want, I realize, to write about the same thing I've always wanted to write about.
I want to write about love, I say.
Bianca nods.
Then do that. Write about love.
After one last group hug, I deposit my friends in an airport-bound cab. Mom and I wave as they retreat, the sun setting brilliantly behind them. I think, as I always do at sunrise and sunset, about the tiny mosaic in my bedroom. The colors of Nicolette. The colors of hope. Back inside, we set up the camera and recorder and get back to work. A month goes by. I garden with my mother during the day, the recorder running as we talk. We listen to music while we cook at night, all of Dad's old favorites. Afterward, we look through photo albums and watch old home movies. I treasure every word she gives me, not just the ones about my father, but the ones about her, too. She was right when she said it wasn't too late to know him, but the thing I'm realizing is, it's not too late to know her either. Sometimes, on the very rare occasions when we wrap up work early in the day, we'll sit outside on the grass, drinking beer and darning socks while the sun melts into the horizon, painting everything with its glory. Sunset, I learn, is my mother's favorite time of day. It relaxes her more than a hot shower or a glass of wine or anything else to watch another day come to a close, everything in its right place. We video call with Audrey when she's able, and she tells us about her work and asks us about ours. My mother isn't a different person. I'm not either. But she asks me to send her a few of my favorite stories I've written, and sometimes when she's reading them at night on the couch opposite from me, she even laughs. She pushes her wireframe glasses on top of her head and looks at me and says something like, "You're so much like him." Something that makes me feel not just seen, but loved, liked. Theo texts me a couple of times, but when I give as little in our exchanges as he does, they quickly peter out. It's not a breakup because it wasn't a relationship, and I'm okay with that. I try not to think too much about Hayden, but he's everywhere. In 1 month, he invaded every facet of my reality, like the Cosmo Sinclair song, "Hayden, Hayden, all the time." I'm still doing work for The Scratch, but mostly short-form pieces, with phone interviews and email exchanges. Once I go to Atlanta for a weekend to interview a chef, but mostly I spend that whole first month at my mother's side, her shadow once more, but still my own person. 5 weeks after my friends left, I talk her into ordering pizza again. "It was pretty good," she allows, then negotiates. "No more than once per month, though." We shake on it, and then I call the order in. She's in the shower when it arrives, and I'm putting the finishing touches on a fresh salad. "Coming!" I shout in the general direction of the door, then rinse my oniony fingers and pat them against my legs as I jog toward the door. I swing it open, and the sunset blinds me for just a second before the inky blot in front of me resolves into a person. A tall, devastatingly handsome, walking, talking glower of a person. "Hayden," I gasp, feeling vaguely like I've run at a dead sprint into a wall. He stares at me, face hard and impassive as ever.
"What is this?"
he asks sharply and holds up a piece of paper. Nothing fancy, notebook paper with blue ink scrawled across it, front and back, my handwriting. For a split second, I go ice cold with the fear that I mailed the letter to the wrong person, him instead of Margaret. Then I realize the flaw in that theory. I don't even have Hayden's address.
"Does it look familiar?"
he asks me. I try to speak. No sound comes out. When he realizes I'm not going to answer, his eyes drop to the front of it. He clears his throat and reads tersely,
"Dear Margaret, you asked me once if you could trust Hayden. I told you that you could, but that wasn't the whole truth."
I know what it says. I weakly manage, but he goes on.
"Yes, he has some walls up, the same as you do, and just like you, he has his reasons. He's careful about who he lets in, but when he does, he loves them wholly. He's blunt and he's honest, but he's never cruel or unkind. He can be hard to read, but he doesn't play games. He doesn't sleep well. He knows where every 24-hour diner is within 40 minutes of Little Crescent, and probably where all of them are back in his own neighborhood, too. He's careful about his health. He doesn't have a complete family medical history to rely on, so he tries not to take risks. He's funny, very funny, but because he's so dry about it, it might take you a while to realize that. He never wears shorts. He's afraid of snakes, but not so scared he wouldn't protect you from one if it came to it. He's generous and thoughtful, and every second you spend not getting to know him is a second wasted. I don't know what your daughter will say if you ask again for a chance to know her, and I can't know for sure what Hayden would say either. But I know he takes life seriously. I know he's not the kind of person to put off uncomfortable conversations now and regret not having them later. He is, I think, the most wonderful person I've ever met, and in the interest of full disclosure, I have a personal stake in whether you tell him the truth or not, because I love him with every fiber of my being, and as someone once told me, when you love someone, you do anything to give them what they need. You unmake the world and build a new one. I've already lost him, but maybe you don't have to. Either way, he deserves the chance to say yes or no. He deserves to be asked, your friend, I think, I hope, Alice Scott.
He stares down at the page for several seconds, and I stand there, trembling with nerves and raw emotion. Finally, his eyes lift to mine, his face etched with tension. How did you get that? I force out.
She sent it to me, he says, along with her own letter, explaining what happened.
My eyes burn, my cheeks burn, my skin burns, even as my insides feel chilled.
Is it true?
He says, finally. What? I whisper.
Is it true?
He says. I'm sorry, I couldn't tell you. I get out. I wanted to tell you.
Is.
He steps in closer, the letter falling to his side.
It true?
About Margaret's connection to you? I ask. His chin moves to the left 1 inch.
That you love me.
The tears break. Of course it's true. How could it not be? I loved you almost instantly before I really even knew you, before I understood it. I trusted you, and I loved you, and I still do.
Good,
he says, taking another small step toward the open door.
Because I love you too. I love you so much, and I don't want to be without you ever again. I'll move to Los Angeles. I'll find a new job, whatever.
Hayden!
Don't try to talk me out of it, Alice,
he says.
Every time we try to protect each other, all it does is cost us more time together, and I'm not willing to lose anymore. I want to be with you. Nothing else is going to matter to me more than that. Not at the end of my life. Not even now. Nothing will matter more than who I spent my time with, and I want it to be you. I need it. To be you.
I've done more crying in the last 2 months than in the 2 years prior, and I'm determined to hold these tears back, to be cool, calm, and steady until the end of this conversation.
Okay,
he says, ducking his head to hold my eyes. I love that plan, I whisper. And I'm so grateful and honored. But there's a problem. His brow rumples, an expression that hits my heart like one of Cupid's arrows.
What?
I'm not going back to Los Angeles, I say. I'm staying in Georgia for now, maybe forever, I don't know. I'm working on something new, and even when it's over, I think I'm going to want to be close to my mom while she's still healthy. I love you. So much, but I can't miss out on more time with her. I did that with my dad, and I need this, and I'm sorry, because if it was anything else, I'd give up anything else. But I don't think I can give up on this, and I know I can't expect you to wait for me, but I wish that... He takes my face in his hands while I'm still rambling.
Alice.
I'd love it if you interrupted me right now. I whisper, heart heavy in my chest. He smiles.
I hear Atlanta's a great place to be a music journalist.
Just like that, my resolution not to cry snaps. Tears fall hard and fast, sliding down my nose, dripping onto my chin. Really? I ask wetly.
Really?
He says. Are you sure? Because... This time he does interrupt me, our mouths colliding, my hands in his hair, his flat and firm against my back, molding me to him, drinking me in. I hold on to him as tight as I possibly can, the sunset scorchingly bright, all that hope gathered in one place. We pull apart just enough to rest our foreheads together, his hand moving softly, lovingly up and down my back.
When I let myself dream.
He murmurs against my ear.
Or it all comes crashing down. It's Alice, Alice on my mind. Alice all the time.
The story. Their version.
Pulitzer-winning biographer Hayden Anderson teams up with celebrity journalist Alice Scott on salacious new Margaret Ives biography, From the Far Side of the World. Our version? It's a love story. Like everything I write, that's what it comes down to. That's what always matters most to me about any interview subject. Whom do you love? What makes your heart beat? For whom would you unmake the world, and how would you build a new one? We tell the truth, mostly. Nicolette, though, is a casualty. It's the only way. Hayden's mother doesn't want to be known, not in that way, but she's open to knowing her biological mother. Open, if not eager. There's a path forward, and it will end wherever it ends. All they can do is walk it at their own pace. Margaret's moving slower these days, moving less. She can't tend to her own garden, but Mom and I drive down to work in it often. Hayden comes up from the city to meet us. Sometimes we take the airboat out and collect trash, bring it home, and watch Margaret fit all these broken pieces together into something beautiful. As much as I love my mosaic, I give it back to Margaret, and it sits in a place of honor on her mantle, until one day, it doesn't. What happened to it? I ask her while I'm dusting her bookshelves.
Send it off with a letter, she says.
I don't press her. She'll tell me more when she wants to. Or maybe she won't. She's being brave where it counts. The book is a hit. The message boards go wild. Some of them are onto something, though just far enough off the mark to not figure out the truth. Cosmo Sinclair is still alive, I swear. You can just feel it in the way MI talks about him, one conspiracy theorist writes, and hundreds more upvote the comment. In a way, he is. His memory will never be lost now. It was passed on to his grandson. It will be passed on to our daughter. We didn't expect it, but almost overnight, Hayden becomes the kind of man who sings to my pregnant belly, who sends dozens of, what about this name, texts over the course of the day. Sometimes when we're working in our separate offices, 4 feet apart in our new home. We don't settle on one until we're driving to the hospital, my contractions getting closer and closer. In the hospital waiting room, my mother and Hayden's take turns pacing. Every 30 seconds, Jody or Margaret or Cecil or Audrey or Priya or Bianca or Killian or Hayden's brother Louis texts us some variation of, is she here yet? Until finally, she is. Laura Grace Anderson Scott is born at 11:53 p.m. She slips in just under the wire on a Tuesday. Half him, half me, entirely her own. Hayden holds her against his chest with tears in his eyes, our whole world packed into this tiny, impossible thing, and I've never felt anything like the love that spreads through my heart. Like I swallowed the sun, like it's breaking up every bit of darkness inside me. I know I would do anything to protect her. Anything to make the world better for her. In that moment, I feel closer to my parents, both of them, than I ever have in my life. And strangely, I find myself thinking about the meandering path of broken glass around Margaret's workshop, about the unicursal labyrinth. I find myself thinking that maybe every bit of heartbreak in life can be rearranged and used for something beautiful, that it doesn't really matter whether I chose this path or I was born onto it, so long as I stop and appreciate the path itself. 4 months after Laura's born, once she finally starts sleeping better, I sit down with the notes I've spent years compiling with my mother and a blank document on my computer, a freshly brewed cup of coffee sitting at my elbow where Hayden left it for me. I crack my knuckles, and then I start to write. Everything I want to tell her someday. Not just the headlines, but the whole truth. The good and bad, the magic and curses, all the blues and grays right alongside the reds and golds. I tell her the story about a love so powerful it remade the world for her. I welcome her to this great, big, beautiful life. This is Julia Whalen. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Great Big Beautiful Life by Emily Henry. This program was produced by Kelly Gilday, edited by JSR Post. Text copyright 2025 by Emily Henry Books, LLC. Production copyright 2025 Penguin Random House, LLC. Please note that no part of this audiobook may be used or reproduced in any manner for the purpose of training artificial intelligence technologies or systems. All rights reserved.